This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, there's a new version of the reparations bill that John Conyers introduces in Congress every year. TPP is finally dead, but NAFTA still remains among the undead, like Dracula. And a veteran Black activist in Greenville, South Carolina, makes her case against police impunity.
But first, February 1st is the kickoff of a national push to establish a single-payer health care system by allowing everyone to join the Medicare program. The campaign is called Health Over Profit for Everyone, or HOPE. For decades, polls have shown that large majorities of Americans support single-payer health care. Dr. Margaret Flowers, a pediatrician and veteran political activist, says single-payer takes on even greater urgency with the dismantling of Obamacare.
That's right. We were pushing for national improved Medicare for All back in 2009, 2010, when they, created the Affordable Care Act. We knew it wouldn't be affordable, and that was starting to fall apart. But now, under the Trump administration and the Republican Congress, they're making good on their promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And so this creates an even greater urgency as tens of millions of more people will lose their health insurance. Add that to the 30 million people that still don't have health insurance. So we think that this is absolutely the right time for us to be pushing for the solution that most people in the United States have been wanting for a very long time, a national improved Medicare for all.
Clearly, the Republicans and the Trump administration are dismantling Obamacare, but the Democratic leadership seems only intent on salvaging aspects of the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, it's very disappointing because, as I said, the Affordable Care Act was already failing. It's, leaving tens of millions of people out. The premiums are rising. The coverage is shrinking. And so, it's just not making it possible for people to still be able to afford the health care that they need. But the Democrats have taken the position, and it's like they just can't go against, their funders. Their campaign funders is what it boils down to. They just refuse to see the obvious solution. So they've decided instead to kind of rally around trying to save components of the Affordable Care Act instead of really responding to what their base wants, which is a national improved Medicare for all. It's interesting that 80% of Democratic voters want a single-payer health care system. And now the polls are showing that even Republicans, particularly those with lower incomes, are moving into the majority support for national improved Medicare for all.
Yes, all this talk about how many additional millions of people have been covered by the Affordable Care Act failed to list those who effectively are not covered, even though they have that insurance. For example, someone quite close to me has to pay a $7,100 deductible, meaning, she doesn't have insurance at all, really.
That's right. What the Affordable Care Act was, it really established underinsurance as the norm and drove more people to be underinsured, including the once gold standard of health insurance was employee benefits. But now those have been driven in the direction of having higher deductibles, higher co-pays. The insurance companies create more restrictive networks so that people are often driven out of network where they have to pay more of the cost. So having health insurance in the United States does not mean that you have access to health care. It does not protect people.
The last time we saw a lineup or a countable group of folks on the Hill who supported single-payer health care was 2009. But that's when President Obama basically crushed those Democrats who were in favor of single-payer. What kind of support do you think exists right now for single-payer on the Hill?
Well, even, you know, Senator Sanders, who was one of the biggest proponents of a national improved Medicare for all, has backed down, and he's saying, you know, let's protect the Affordable Care Act now and we'll fight for single payer later. We're saying, no, we need to fight for single payer now. Fortunately, Congressman John Conyers did reintroduce just this week, H.R. 676, which is the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act. We would love to see a senator introduce the companion bill to that. But the reality is that members of Congress, you know, we saw that this was off the table under a Democratic majority, White House and Congress. And so the reality is for the people is that when we organize and work together strategically and demand that this is the only solution we'll support, that's when we're going to get it.
Yes, one would have hoped to see a million person march on Washington in favor of this broadly and deeply favored kind of legislation.
I think we're moving in that direction. You know, I work with people across the country that are advocates for this, and what we're hearing in all the circles is that people are fed up and this is what they want. And so this campaign, Health Over Profit for Everyone, or HOPE, the website is healthoverprofit.org, is designed to make a single-payer healthcare system at the national level the only politically feasible solution within the next 4 years.
And when you say politically feasible, what do you mean?
The reality of the healthcare crisis is not going to go away, but one movable factor in here is kind of the political winds, what members of Congress are willing to do. And just like with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we had a 5.5-year campaign to make that politically toxic so that members of Congress felt like they had to run away from it. And it became a major issue in the 2016, you know, election campaign. It's part of the reason why Donald Trump won. And so we need to do the same thing around National Improved Medicare for All, that members of Congress feel that they have to run on a platform of supporting it in order to get the votes to get elected. So the political culture is something that we as people have the power to impact, and that's what our job is.
Now, Donald Trump has said many things, and at some points in time, he has seemed to be in favor of something that sounded kind of like single payer.
It's interesting. Yeah, he sometimes says things that he believes that all people should have coverage, that he, you know, supports Medicare. He has said before that he supported single payer, that he thought it was a good idea. So, you know, it really, the reality here is that when the people lead, the leaders will follow. And so we're saying to Donald Trump, you could cement your legacy as the most popular president in history if you give people a national improved Medicare for all. The reality is that it's the people that are going to make that happen, and it's the people that should take credit for that. But, you know, we know under a Democratic presidency, we couldn't have this. It's off the table for the Republicans. It's up to us to put it on the table.
That was Dr. Margaret Flowers speaking from Baltimore.
Every year since 1989, Detroit Black Congressman John Conyers has introduced his bill on reparations for Black Americans. This year, the bill has been updated. Cam Howard, chairman of the Legislative Committee of INCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, helped Conyers' staff write the new version of the bill, H.R. 40.
The original bill that Congressman Conyers has introduced since 1989 was entitled the Commission to Study Reparations Proposals for African American Value. It was designed to, one, study whether or not there was injury among current African Americans from the legacy of enslavement and segregation. And if there was injury, the commission would then make proposals for repair. Since 2001, the World Conference Against Racism, the whole issue of continued injury was settled at that World Conference Against Racism. The declaration that came out of that conference stated that there was injury, continued injury, for people of African descent globally as a result of enslavement and segregation, colonialism and apartheid, and that there was an obligation on behalf of those who committed those injuries or those crimes, as they were called, to make repair. And so we saw that the National African American Reparations Commission that was convened by Dr. Ron Daniels saw that H.R. 40, as it was written and being introduced, was kind of obsolete because that question had already been settled. So the issue was that the focus should be on remedies, not on trying to ascertain if there was continued injury, because that was pretty much accepted standard. globally. So we introduced a new bill, which is entitled the Commission to Study and Develop Reparation Proposals. And this, the focus is on remedy. And remedy is comport with international norms on repair. So that's also extremely important.
And so how does this new and broader focus affect the mandate of those who are pushing for reparations?
It begins with remedies. So the commission would not be trying to find out whether or not reparations are due, but it begins with the focus that reparations are due and how do this government engage in reparative initiatives. So it changes the whole conversation because in America, the mainstream still wants to have the argument of should there be reparations? Well, we don't even entertain that conversation. Should there be? It's already determined that there must be. And so we begin the conversation with how is repair acted out?
Could Congressman Conyers have phrased his original wording so tentatively in order to make it more palatable to folks on the right?
That was the conversation of should we use reparations or should we use reparative justice or should we even use repair in the wording at all? And I think the consensus was is that these were crimes against humanity, the most gross types of crimes that a state can commit, and something that never happened before in history in this magnitude, as the international community has declared. And so we were adamant about calling it what it was. And the conversation around redress for these injuries is one that America just has to have, and we had to have it honestly. And so there was agreement that we would continue to use the word reparations in the bill.
The main group, of course, that needs to be energized behind reparations is Black people themselves. Do you think the new wording will be effective in doing that?
Yeah, that's one of the things that we're building around. Is that a lot of Black people were saying that H.R. 40 is just a study bill. And so when they had the conversation, when they entered the conversation, it was entering from a viewpoint of it really doesn't do anything. And so now that it is a remedy bill, we think that we can energize our people to really get behind it if it's explained right and if we can inform them around what the full notion of repair is and what this bill seeks to do in regards to international norms around reparations. So it's not just about a check. And so in this bill, we spell out what full reparations is and what this commission is designed to address projects and policies in alignment with these international norms and reparations. So we think that if we can share this type of information with our community, then we can get them behind the bill.
Recent scholarship explores how slavery was not some kind of anomaly or a vestige of feudalism, but it was a very capitalist enterprise that was central to the development of capitalism in this country and in the world.
Yes, that's true. And I think it was Eric Williams in Slavery and Capitalism who wrote that the slave trade was the primitive capital that undergirded the whole system of capitalism. There was no excessive resources or capital before enslavement for so-called capitalism to grow. And so the whole global economic order today is built on the transatlantic slave trade or the European slave trade of Africans and the enslavement of African people.
Yes, and what I'm trying to get at here is that the new wording may make it easier in a practical as well as theoretical way to make the case against, for example, these capitalist enterprises that the movement has already charged with being liable for reparations, as well as the system as a whole, as well as the government that presides over that system.
That's exactly right. You look at the major institutions, banking, finance, insurance, railroads, all the mining institutions, energy institutions in this country, all of those were either financed by Bank of America. You know, all of these institutions got their start from the theft of African labor, from the resources that were gained from the theft of African labor. And so we, according to the Durban Declaration again in 2001, that all of these entities, if they're still in existence, they're criminal entities, and that they also are obligated to engage in the repair of African people.
You know, all of these big capitalists call themselves jobs providers, but one could take that and maintain that they were also the slavery enablers as well.
That's exactly right. We did a mobilization against Norfolk Southern Railroad in Chicago a few years ago, and they brought out in the city hall what we were challenging them. They brought dozens of black contractors who they had used and was saying how they gave them all these jobs. And we made it clear that, yeah, you know, we never said that they didn't value black labor. It's just that they just recently started paying for it. So they've always, they've used us to build their wealth in the past. In fact, their wealth is founded on the theft of our labor. So, yeah, we're definitely in agreement of that.
Back to the problem of getting popular support around reparations, there was a time when reparations was on the lips of lots of folks, and it was a standard subject for black political conversation, but not so much anymore. Is that your impression?
That is my impression. There's several reasons for that, you know, with several reasons that are being discussed for that. One is the bombing of the Trade Center in 2001. That was a major victory coming out of Durban. But 2 days after the Durban victory, there was the bombing of the Trade Center. And so that whole victory, global victory, was lost due to the focus on so-called terrorism. And that really trumped all the news in this country for maybe 5 or 6 years or so. So that was one instance. Another reason is the defeat of the lawsuit. Not defeat, but the judge not hearing the lawsuit. So there was a lot of emphasis placed on the lawsuit. You know, a lot of Africans had contributed money to NCOBRA and to other entities to engage that legal struggle. And a lot of people were really hyped about it. And when the judge threw out that lawsuit and said it was a political issue and not a legal issue, that kind of dampened the spirit of a lot of our people who were fighting for reparations.
Could you please explain the lawsuit that you're talking about?
Yeah, that was a lawsuit that I think Deidre Pellman Farmer raised against the corporations, Aetna Insurance, Fleet Boston, I think Brown University, Chase Bank, a few other institutions. And I think there was a couple of other lawsuits. And then the federal government combined all of those lawsuits into one. And it was argued in the federal district court here in Chicago. And in 2005, the judge ruled that we procedurally didn't have grounds to bring a case, that he didn't rule on the case itself, but ruled that he couldn't hear it because we procedurally defaulted. One, that the statute of limitations had ran out, that in order to bring a case before the federal court, you have 6 years once you know that a harm was done to bring a case to court. So this happened 100 years of Jim Crow segregation ended in 1965. So that was thrown out, that we were too far removed from the injury. And in American tort law, you have to either have been injured yourself, have been the parent or the son, or in some cases, the grandchild can sue on behalf of the parent. But they said, the judge ruled we were too far removed from the injury. And that I think that was another issue that he dealt with. And plus the sovereign immunity thing, the government had to give you permission to sue them. Those were the things that precluded him from hearing the case on its merits.
Isn't that amazing that in 2005, the year of Katrina, a judge would rule that the damage done to black folks during slavery and in the immediate aftermath was too far removed? And then we have Katrina, which shows that the vestiges of slavery are definitely still here.
That's exactly right. And that's why we begin the notion, this new bill, with the notion that the vestiges are here, so we're not removed from because of this ongoing injury. And the international community has accepted that. We weren't able to bring that type of information before the court, that the international community already settled it 4 years earlier, that there's continued injury. and that the statute of limitations, there is no statute of limitations to crimes against humanity. If the crime happened 400 years ago and the criminals are still in existence, like the American government is still in existence, or corporations are still in existence, they're criminal today. And so there is no such thing as a statute of limitations in regards to the injuries of, in regards to the crimes of enslavement and segregation. So we can mount a new legal challenge, and in COBRA, I think, are going to have that discussion, some of our lawyers, at our conference in June in Dallas around the Juneteenth weekend. And so there's going to be a legal, our legal commission will reestablish themselves under the leadership of Attorney Ajua Ayotero. We're going to revisit, you know, a legal challenge to reparations.
Is there any expectation that the U.S. judicial system will actually recognize the positions and pronouncements and rulings of international bodies?
Well, there are certain treaties that the U.S. is signatory to. And so under the Constitution, those treaties also become, quote unquote, the law of the land when the U.S. Entered into those treaties. And so we can certainly explore American courts utilizing international law. We can also explore some of these international courts, like the courts of American states, International Court of American States, which U.S. is a body of. And so we're not just limited to the courts inside the United States anymore. We also have international venues that we can also present a case before. But the thing about a lawsuit is it requires a lot of money, because these people bring legions of attorneys. Like in the lawsuit in 2005, each corporation brought 10 or 12 attorneys. So there were like 10 corporations and 100 attorneys, 100 and plus attorneys on the sides of these criminals, man. So these are extremely expensive battles. And so we have to mount another national campaign for fundraising around a legal issue. And in order to do that, we had to build the belief among our people that victory can be accomplished.
And what is the core support on Capitol Hill for the revised Conyers bill on reparations?
Well, one of the things Conyers staff wanted was to have 30 original co-sponsors sign on to the bill at the time he introduced it. And the original co-sponsors, just that, someone who signs on the bill when a bill is introduced saying that they support the bill. In the past, the most there's been is like 23 original co-sponsors, and that was, you know, during the height of the reparations movement where we had 23 co-sponsors, and I think we ended up with about 40, 43, 45, 48, somewhere around there. But we were able to get, within a week time, we were able to get, just right before the holiday, 20 original co-sponsors. We went back and found some of all those who had co-sponsored in the past, told them about the new bill. And so 14 are CBC members, there's two Hispanic members, and six Caucasian members of the Democratic Party. There is one sister on the CBC who's a Republican, and we're pushing for full CBC support, which would be 47. I think there are 47 congresspersons, and we have two senators. So that was something else, is that, you know, the goal is to get 100 co-sponsors to move this legislation, but we need a senator to write a companion bill. And so we have two senators at this time, senators of African descent. So we're hopeful that we can get a Senate companion bill once we build the momentum around in the House of Representatives.
That was Cam Howard of InCobra speaking from Chicago.
TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, President Obama's so-called free trade bill, is finally dead. President Trump signed the papers killing the measure last week. However, Lori Wallach, director of Global Trade Watch for Public Citizen, warns that NAFTA and other corporate trade schemes are still very much alive.
The TPP was killed by years of campaigning by progressive folks and union activists around the country, but also in the other TPP countries. It was really international citizen power that beat multinational corporate power. And Donald Trump then came in and he basically buried the moldering corpse of an agreement that was already dead. It couldn't get a majority in the U.S. Congress in the entire year after it was signed. And then you look at the cabinet of someone like Trump, which is packed with folks who support TPP and NAFTA and who are a bunch of corporate chieftains who have not been good to working people. And I think it's fair to have a kind of skepticism about the prospects that a renegotiation of NAFTA run by Donald Trump is necessarily going to work out really well for a lot of Americans. Now, of course, we hope, we can hope, and we can pressure to try and make sure that whatever they do with that certainly very damaging existing NAFTA works out for people on the planet. But I think it's very risky to assume that's how it's going to play out.
Well, NAFTA has been like a curse word on Donald Trump's lips for a long time, but you seem to be saying that we need to exercise some real due diligence to make sure that the entire global corporate system is demolished root and branch.
Well, you know, you can agree that something is bad without agreeing what is good. I think we can all agree we don't want to eat gravel, but if someone serves us up ground glass, well, that's bad too. We want a trade agreement that isn't just another version of special rigged rules and privileges for fat cats and big multinational corporations. We want something that works for working people and small businesses, that doesn't undermine our family's ability to have safe food and affordable medicine, that gives our kids and grandkids a livable planet. And that kind of an agreement is going to take people having a say in it, not a closed-door process with a bunch of corporate fat cats, of which 500 already are official advisors, and the Trump administration has done nothing to change that, to the trade process. So I think we need to keep a close eye to whether what is a very bad NAFTA gets made better or gets made worse.
The counterpart to the Pacific TPP is the Atlantic Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And Donald Trump's administration has not moved publicly against that agreement.
I think it remains to be seen what the Trump administration is going to do with respect to the three big trade agreements that are sort of left over from the previous administration. And the European one is basically on life support because there's such strong opposition to it in Europe. It had become basically, sadly, a venue for the big multinational corporations in the U.S. and in Europe to get together and push down the best standards in either country. So, for instance, Europe has better food safety protections, and the U.S. agribusiness guys are in cahoots with their counterparts in Europe to try and bring down those higher standards in Europe. The U.S. has stronger financial regulations, and the big banks in Germany and London and the U.S. Wall Street guys were in cahoots trying to use that negotiation to bring that down. So it's with appreciation to our European brothers and sisters that we can say that one was a kind of on life support. Trump hasn't said what he's going to do about it, but I wouldn't be shocked if that one is given also a dignified burial like the TPP. However, there are two other agreements, a U.S.-China bilateral agreement that is live and super dangerous that the Trump administration hasn't said a word about. And there's a thing called the Trade-in Services Agreement, which could be called the Trump-in Services Agreement. It's 11 of the countries where he has businesses out of 28 countries altogether in an agreement that's all about service sector. So many of the businesses he's invested in, hotels, real estate development, construction, retail, tourism, project management, and this agreement is basically being fought against by the teachers' unions and the civil servants' unions all across the countries involved because it would privatize and deregulate everything. And not a peep from Donald Trump on that one either.
Well, if Donald Trump doesn't support living wages and workers' rights here at home, how could anybody believe that he really wants to end U.S. involvement in what some of us call the global race to the bottom in the service industry as well as the manufacturing?
Well, that's a very good question. What's an interesting little paradox is that some of the folks he's appointed to be his top trade officials are actually that handful of conservatives who work on trade who see low standards, labor standards, wages, low environmental standards, as really a competitive disadvantage against the U.S. So their approach, for instance, has been for some time, some of these appointees, is to try and get the poorer countries with whom the U.S. is trading to have to raise their standards so that the U.S. can compete. A lot of the other people who the president has appointed into the new administration want to lower our wages and our standards so that we can compete in a race to the bottom. And it remains to be seen which direction, say, a NAFTA negotiation is going to go.
You seem to be saying that there is no coherent line in the Trump administration. Some folks look at his administration and see a situation in which it looks like Trump, just based on his rhetoric alone, is like a party of one.
I do think, as much as I wouldn't necessarily in my human form want to be any place nearby, it would be interesting in my mouse form to be peeping up and seeing what the heck goes on over there, because it is discombobulating. It does cause mental exhaustion to try and understand how the heck policy is being made over there or not.
And what about the configuration on Capitol Hill with NAFTA as well as with TPP? These bills have gotten more Republican support than Democratic. And in fact, majorities of Democrats voted against NAFTA when Clinton pushed it through, and a similar kind of lineup obtained with TPP.
So the perverse little twist is, if a President Trump wants to pass and implement and enact a renegotiated NAFTA, he is going to have to get with the Democrats, work with them to figure out how to build a majority, which will be comprised of most of the Democrats and then a handful of Republicans. The margins in both the House and the Senate are pretty tight. So if you are able to come up with a deal that has a majority, you're going to have most of one party and a few of the others. And the reality, exactly as you've pointed out, is you will never get a majority of the Republicans in Congress to want to change in a way that could bring down the trade deficit or slow job offshoring the old NAFTA. So the only way you get the math to add up to half of the Congress is you start by making sure you've made the Democrats happy, and then you try and make sure you get a handful of Republicans to join up. And that is a really interesting political dynamic, in that it's going to set President Trump directly crossways with the Republicans in Congress.
And looking at it from the other side, one wonders if the Democrats might actually look a gift horse in the mouth.
It is a very strange scenario where really nothing can be known until there's some more water under the bridge. It may never come down to a scenario of having a NAFTA renegotiation, because if President Trump continues to be so disrespectful to other world leaders, it's unclear, say, the president of Mexico is going to sit down and have a negotiation with the U.S. president, and then maybe the end will be we withdraw from NAFTA, or President Trump isn't able to deliver on his promise. I think there are so many X factors in this. It looks like a whole pass la crossroads. We won't know for a while.
Yes, and in terms of that bilateral prospective deal with China, Trump often sounds like he's about to initiate his own hostile pivot to the East.
It would be mystifying if, after pillaring China on an hourly basis throughout the entire campaign as America's biggest trade problem, and separate from that, just the reality that, in fact, China accounts for more than half of our $700 billion plus trade deficit, that Donald Trump would not stop the agreement that's like NAFTA with China that's hanging out there would be very weird. But we won't know until he makes an announcement if he's going forward with that one, or if he's really going to actually be consistent and shut that one down too.
And what would you, as the Global Trade Watch, recommend in terms of popular actions to push Trump in the desired direction?
Well, you know, what's going to be really important is for folks to get informed. You can go to tradewatch.org to find out about what is going on a day-to-day basis. A new website called www.wehatenafta.org is going to give you updates on the NAFTA renegotiation. And also, at either of those places, you can see a really helpful document where dozens of environmental, union, consumer, family farm, faith, civil rights groups got together. And by the middle of January, had written out 10 things that must and must not be in a NAFTA replacement for that kind of an agreement to put people on the planet first. More jobs, good jobs, higher wages, safe food, affordable medicine, and bring up standards in all the trade partner countries. It's not so much us against them, country to country. It is these big corporations playing workers off of each other in the countries. So, you know, a lot of people in the U.S. lost jobs to NAFTA, a million jobs. But those jobs didn't stay in Mexico for very long. They stayed there first, and then China was cheaper, so a lot of the jobs went to China. It's a global race to the bottom, and we need global rules that put people on the planet first to stop it. One of the most interesting things I saw was a study actually by the auto industry that said that the worker costs, so benefits as well as salary, for auto workers in Mexico, everything together, benefits, everything, is $8 an hour. So salary, benefits, everything, taxes. And the comparable figure for the U.S. is $50. Obviously, the salary is not all of it. It's benefits, it's taxes. But the worker cost per hour, $8 in Mexico, $50 in the U.S. for the auto sector. So if we don't have a floor that brings up the rules, even if NAFTA's incentives to offshore, and there are some direct rules that actually promote offshoring in NAFTA, even if those were taken out, we'd still have the race to the bottom.
That's right. And you're talking about a floor under workers worldwide, and that a floor under U.S. workers doesn't do much good if other workers in the world don't have one.
Exactly. That's because we're internationalists and he's a nationalist, and that's one big difference. None of us were united not liking NAFTA, but very different in what we think the solution is for people on the planet.
That was Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch in Washington.
Ifeo Wangaza is director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination in Greenville, South Carolina, and the leader of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network in that state. The veteran activist thought she'd be going on trial last week for blocking traffic more than 2 years ago in protest against the decision by a grand jury not to indict the cop that killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. However, Greenville authorities dropped the charges the day before her trial, depriving Wangaza of the opportunity to put on a political defense, which she'd looked forward to doing. Wangaza wanted to show a jury why it's necessary to fight against police impunity, and also to make the case that Greenville, South Carolina, is not the kind of town that it pretends to be.
Greenville is what I call a wannabe destination city. So you've got gentrification, or more accurately, anglicization on steroids. And as a part of that, they brought in a new police chief who barely reaches above 5 feet. So he's a certifiable walking Napoleonic conflict who anything that's black that moves should either be locked up or shot. As far as civil liberties are concerned, they are, of course, non-existent. When Mike Brown's murderer, Darren Wilson, was no-billed by the Ferguson grand jury, I organized as a part of the national Day After campaign a shutdown, intersection shutdown here in Greenville, to call attention to the fact that cops killing us, getting a 2-week paid vacation and extended leave would no longer be tolerated. And as a person who has been dealing with this issue since I was 16 and am now 70, that it's clearly necessary to escalate the response and the quality of the protests. So to do an intersection shutdown was a way that I took action against it. The chief of police really wanted to lock all of us up. There were a little bit more than a dozen of us who shut the intersection down, and they ticketed about 9 of us. 8 took the deal that the city offered, which was to waive the fine and to give 90 days to 6 months probation and close the case. My position being that the purpose of the demonstration was to call attention to police impunity and their slaughtering us from one end of the country to the other, and the unacceptability of that provided no space for deal making. Further, that it was a part of a campaign to draw public attention to the epidemic of state violence, police terror, and to confront the public with the facts as could be presented through a trial. So we've been going back and forth for the past 2 years, since December 2014, with them making these offers and me saying, no, I want a jury trial. So finally, we put together the trial. We tested the state requirement that not only is a defendant entitled to a jury trial, even at a misdemeanor, but the state has the duty of providing counsel. So not only was I about to have a jury trial, but I also was provided with an attorney, and surprisingly, a really competent attorney, former prosecutor, in fact. A woman who had worked in the Chicago Innocence Project for over 10 years was co-counsel. So I felt very good about the competency of the counsel, if not their politics. The defense would be one of necessity, that an emergency was afoot. Not only have I been dealing with the issue of police brutality since I was 16 years old, my sister was beaten by police when she living in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, when they ran jeeps over us and horses. They knocked out her front teeth and broke her glasses and tried to arrest her, and we de-arrested her. But my brother, 25 years ago, left the United States saying that they weren't going to shoot him down in the street like a dog or lock him up in a cage, to this escalation as documented first by the October 22nd Coalition Stolen Lives Project, and now, of course, it's viewed as common fact. Everybody thinks that databases have existed all along, but that's, of course, not true. The original grassroots database was done by the Stolen Lives Project, National Lawyers Guild, Center for Constitutional Rights, initiated by the Revolutionary Communist Party with Carl Dix and the October 22nd Coalition. So here we are now, seeing that last year the cops killed 1,153 people, and everybody's supposed to be sympathetic because 68 cops got killed. That's not even 1% of the people that they killed. So we put together a body of witnesses. We had a mass communication instructor from Clemson University, Chenjerai Kumanyika, who has, since Ferguson, visited the various places where there have been outbursts of police violence and a community response. He's been documenting that, interviewing people. So he was to testify on the impact that police terror is having on the community and the siege under which we are living. We have this local sister who's the survivor of both interpersonal and state violence, so that she is in the peculiar position of being able to talk about the impact of both. And the particular frustration and violence that one experiences as a result of state violence, recognizing that in interpersonal violence, regardless of how long it may take, ultimately there is expectation that somebody's going to be punished. Wherein with state violence, one knows the perpetrator, when it happened, how it happened, where it happened, without any likelihood of that person being punished. Not only are they not punished, but they are compensated, promoted, and dubbed a hero. A third witness would have been a former sheriff's deputy who, having been fired from the sheriff's department for becoming overly zealous in his drug arrests so as to include white folks, got fired and has since become a reformer, to talk about the dangerous and hostile aspects of policing at this point, with a particular emphasis on the high level of militarization and use of military tactics and equipment in our communities. Another person who had organized mothers from across the country who did a march from the U.S. Supreme Court to the Capitol demanding that laws be passed to address the issue of impunity and that the Supreme Court interpret the laws in such a way that cops are held accountable, and of course myself to testify. So a broad range of aspects of the issue that would have been addressed. Unfortunately, you can't force the state to prosecute you. So therefore, it was left up to the solicitor to decide whether he was or was not going to prosecute me. And so he decided he wasn't going to prosecute me because it would be bad publicity for the city of Greenville to prosecute me and be putting into jail a 70-year-old woman that has been dealing with the issue of police brutality for more than 50 years. In addition to that, we intend to do a people's tribunal so that the very same evidence that would have been presented at the time of the trial will be presented at the people's tribunal, and other people in the community can come forward and present their own cases so that while we don't have the benefit of the state, we will have the benefit of the public education. And in some ways, I think that we may wind up being even more effective. So they're not entirely off of the hook. We'll be looking for funds to be able to write it up as a report and to circulate it to all these different agencies or organizations that give these livable city awards to begin to challenge the livability of the representation of livability of the city based on the violence that is visited upon the Black community here.
So this is the political trial that should have been, so that you could have highlighted the necessity to respond to the emergency that the police create in the Black community through their violence.
Precisely. And I hope that others will take up the same theory, and whether they do it quote unquote officially or they do it as a people's forum or not, I think that it's important that we do that and raise the level of the sense of entitlement of the community and strengthen the call that has been initiated and advanced by the Uhuru movement for community control of the police.
Now, you've been involved in the movement to free political prisoners for many decades. President Obama has just left the scene, at least he's left the White House, and he did so without freeing any of the Black political prisoners who have been languishing in prison for, in some cases, generations.
That's right. In fact, the United States has the longest held political prisoner in the world, and that is Richelle McGee. Richelle McGee, who was Angela Davis's co-defendant, has been in prison, and I believe he is now at Pelican Bay, which is one of the most hostile prisons in the country. He has been held for over 50 years. We submitted his application for clemency to the United Nations Human Rights Commission, asking that they review it, and they did include it in their review of the United States under the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights. Other political prisoners, of course, exiles would be Sister Assata Shakur, who is in Cuba. Barack Obama was making big deal of reopening communication and relations with Cuba, while at the same time you had the Gusanos, who led the campaign to double the bounty that was on her head, the state of New Jersey having put up $1 million, and then under the Obama administration they added a second $1 million. The call for her capture and return to the United States has again arisen with the Trump administration, and Tollison has assured them that he would do everything in his power to return her to the United States and to prison, of course, against which we must be fighting. There's Veronica Bowers, California Black Panther Party member from Oakland, who was wrongfully convicted of killing a forest ranger, purportedly for having been discovered killing a deer out of season, and has maxed out, spent more than 30 years in prison, which was under the terms of the sentencing structure at the time that he was convicted, would have been 30 years. He has now spent another more than 5 years after having maxed out and after having had the parole board, the federal parole board, to recommend at every turn that he be released. And on each occasion, federal law enforcement has objected, and it's been reviewed and taken back. He's been in court. Federal judge has ordered that he be released. He has not been released. Obama could have easily have released him. And then, of course, you have Dr. Mutulu Shakur, who, with all the good service with regard to drug rehabilitation programs and practices that he brought and that are still being used, every reason in the world to have released him. He, along with Imam Jamil Al-Amin, both of whom are in poor health, and despite incarceration, despite their poor health, have continued to not only serve the community, the prison community, but the outside community as well. There are, of course, others who are in state as opposed to federal custody, but Obama has never done anything that in any way suggested that it might recognize the dignity, worth, and humanity of African people, and to take the step to affirm it.
Yes, President Obama not only has refused to use his powers to free any of this very specific category of Black Panther Party political prisoners, folks who are in prison because of a very specific U.S. government program, COINTELPRO,
exactly.
A program that was unconstitutional and revealed and denounced as such by the U.S. Congress
Senate
itself. But this former president hasn't extended his powers of commutation to Black folks at all.
He wouldn't even pardon Jack Johnson at the request of John McCain, despite the fact that Jack Johnson has been dead for 100 years. Or in the case of Marcus Garvey, who again falls into that same category, but has been dead for almost as long. The level of self-hatred and contempt that Barack Obama has for African people is unrivaled and pales only to the extent to which he manipulates us to his ends and never misses an opportunity to insult and to degrade us as a people.
And yet is all but sanctified by a significant segment of our population.
A certifiable symptom of our pathology.
So now you're gearing up for a public airing of the issues that you wanted to air in that political trial that did not happen. How can people be of service in getting this information out?
Well, first of all, for more information, people can reach us at the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination in Greenville, South Carolina, and one has only to Google that. Our email address is mxcentergvl, which stands for Greenville, at gmail.com. We are in need of funds. We will have the tribunal recorded and transcription done from the recording and or at the time of the tribunal and to make that available to others. So, again, folks can find us by Googling Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination, Greenville, South Carolina, or emailing us at mxcenter, G as in George, V as in Victor, L as in love, at gmail.com.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.